All right, so we can now continue on the Upakilesa Sutta, the corruptions. And we have looked at one of these corruptions so far, which is the corruption of doubt. And doubt sort of obviously is going to stop you from the joy and all of these things. And so obviously it's a problem. It's very nice. When you're a monk, you kind of cough once and the drinks kind of start arriving because you're coughing once. It's kind of... It's very... Okay, so that's good. So let's carry on with these corruptions of the mind and see where this gets us. So again, this is the very interesting, because this is the Buddha-to-be talking about his experience and how he overcame the these defilements of the mind to then obviously take him all the way to awakening, as we shall see as we come towards the end of the sutta. So he then says, while meditating heedful, keen, and diligent, I perceived both light and vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what's the cause? What's the reason why my light and vision of forms vanish? It occurred to me, loss of focus arose in me. And because of that, my immersion fell away. When immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. I'll make sure that neither doubt nor loss of focus will arise in me again. So loss of focus here is amanasikara, amanasikara, which means like lack of attention. Yeah, you lose the attention on the object, which is like loss of focus. And this can happen for a number of reasons. It can happen, for example, that you some external thing impinges on you. Maybe you hear a sound or something happens that takes your attention away from the object. Yeah, you lose your focus on what is going on. It can also be that you kind of lose your focus when you come to these things. You want to be very focused on kind of the middle and the most pertinent, important aspect of the experience. So if there is like a vision and light, you want to be in the center of that. You want to stay with the object as centered as you possibly can. As soon as the mindfulness or the attention wavers a little bit and you go to the edges of the experience or whatever, then again you lose that razor sharp focus which is required to take this really deep, and so that's a kind of also a loss of attention in a sense. So the idea here when these things arise is to stay with them as focused as possible in the center of the experience, seeing the beauty of the experience, because it is that centeredness which give rise to great stillness. The more you move around, the less stillness there is. The more you focus not on the most beautiful part, you will then not develop that beauty and that joy and that happiness further. So you want to stay with the center of things. That's kind of the idea here. One kind of minor point as well, you can notice here that this is called a kind of samadhi, yeah? Stillness of the mind, immersion, being Bhantasiddhanta's translation of samadhi. So not all samadhi is jhana samadhi. There are also lesser kinds of samadhi. And really the meaning of samadhi is just that you're not distracted. That's kind of the idea. If the mind is scattered and distracted to other things, then it's not samadhi. So samadhi really just means the ability to focus on something. That's what it kind of comes down to. And this leaves a kind of interpretation problem in the suttas. Because when the suttas say samadhi, how do we know what the Buddha is talking about? What kind of samadhi does he mean? Does it mean the samadhi that arises from walking meditation? Does it mean the samadhi of what we have here, the lights and the vision of forms? Or does it mean the jhanas? Or what does it mean? And the answer is that it can include many of these things. But the way, again, to interpret things is to ask, well, what is the most common usage of these terms in the suttas? Yeah, and the most common use of the word samadhi is always the four jhanas. The four jhanas are everywhere. Yeah, this is samma samadhi. And of course, samma samadhi, samma means here like right. Yeah, right stillness is obviously what we want. Yeah, we don't want wrong stillness for obvious reasons. We want the right stillness. And so we can assume that when the Sutta says samadhi, the main reference is always the jhanas. It can be wide, that would be the main reference. And so this is, again, one way of learning gradually how to interpret the suttas in the right way. So, but here it means must mean something less. We haven't yet arrived at the jhanas yet, so here it means something less. Okay, so you overcome the doubt, you overcome the lack of attention, and then the Buddha carries on. While meditating, dullness and drowsiness arose in me. And then again he inquires into the causes. Yeah, everything is about inquiring into causes. And then he understands that this is the problem. And then he thinks, I'll make sure that neither doubt nor loss of focus nor dullness and drowsiness will arise in me again. It may seem strange, you know, when you are so bright, you're seeing lights and visions of forms, and you've gone a long way down the path of samadhi already. There's bound to be a lot of pity and sukha there, lots of joy and happiness. How can you be dull? How can you be drowsy? This is like the anti-drowsiness, yeah? Seeing these bright lights and things, having the joy in the mind. So what does it actually mean? And it's important to understand here that this is a relative kind of drowsiness and dullness. It is a tiny bit of dullness, tiny bit of loss of energy in the mind is sort of what it means here. The energy is not maxed out, so to speak, right? And this is what is meant here. You're losing a little bit of that brightness. And so for whatever reason, why this may happen. And then as a result of that, the mind then loses that focus. And again, it relates to how you're focusing on the object. Are you focusing on the most powerful, the most energetic aspect of that object in the mind? Are you focusing on the joy and the happiness, or are you allowing your attention to waver a little bit? And as long as you stay with the most delightful and beautiful part, the energy will be strong, because energy comes from the sense of being attracted to something, being drawn towards something. The mind is energized precisely because of that happiness. So you stay with that. You don't allow the mind to waver or to lose its attention and these kind of things. And then you don't have these problems. So you want to sustain the energy. Otherwise, you're going to have a problem. So dullness and drowsiness here is a kind of a thing. It can also be the case that after a while, if you stay with these for too long, the mind sort of, okay, it comes a point when the mind withdraws from the meditation. You may have noticed that meditation often happens in, it's kind of a cyclical thing. It happens according to certain patterns. You start out, then you kind of go become more and more quiet. And it comes a point you reach a plateau, like the meditation comes to a maximum. And then suddenly the mind kind of withdraws. It's like it's had enough or something. Yeah, it's like there's a certain natural pattern to the meditation very often. Not always, but often it's like this. And then it's important to follow those patterns, follow the natural cycle of meditation, not try to override these things or go beyond what is natural. So when you find yourself coming out of the meditation, okay, then you come out, yeah, and then you stop, and you do something else for a while. And that's why I say, then when you do walking meditation, there may not be any need to focus on the feet. Do something else for a while, because the mind needs some alternative sometimes. Not always doing the same thing, not always doing samatha and calming and tranquility, but sometimes doing a bit of reflection, contemplation, whatever it might be, or just enjoying the mindfulness or the beautiful weather here. It's so beautiful outside. You walk around and there's something about these winter days when the sun is quite low and the light is quite soft and gentle. Yeah, it's really magnificent here in the Australian bush and in the forest here on these days. I don't know what you, but I find it so delightful outside. And you kind of just walk around a bit and you enjoy the delight of Jhana Grove, staying for a while, and then you come back again when the mind is ready, and then you can kind of start a new cycle of meditation again. And if you force it too much, the mind will rebel at a certain point, and then you won't be able to. The meditation will not work. So try to go with the flow. Yeah, be sensitive to how your mind works. And then there is much greater chance you will succeed as a consequence. All right. So while meditating diligent, keen, and resolute, again you perceive light and visions of forms, but then they disappeared. It occurred to me, what is the reason and the cause? And now the reason is that terror aroused in me. In other words, fear. Yeah? And because of that, my samadhi fell away. When the samadhi falls away, the light and the vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was traveling along a road and killers were to spring out at them from both sides. They would feel terrified because of that. In the same way, terror aroused in me. Then the Buddha-to-be decides, I will make sure that neither doubt nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror will arise in me again. And this is a very, this is quite strong language here, and very the idea of some killers coming out from both sides. It seems like over the top, right? You're meditating, for goodness sake. What do you mean killers coming out from both sides? And this is the interesting thing about meditation when it starts to become deep, is that you are giving up certain things within you that are very close to you, very dear to you, things that you always have regarded as aspects of who you are. Yeah, things that are aspects of your identity. And to be able to go beyond these things, it is as if you have to let go of parts of yourself. You have to give up your sense of identity, give up your almost like your existence in a way. And one of the most important things that we give up on this path of meditation is the will, is the doer inside. And you will notice this, the more quiet you are, the less doing there is, the less the doer is active. And you can see that actually it is a very beautiful thing when that happens, because it feels very positive. Doing drains the energy. Doing is, actually it is a pain in the end. Peace is far preferable to doing. This is one of the obvious things that you see in meditation practice. And yet there comes a point when you give up the doer so much that it feels like you are almost like you're committing suicide. You're giving up something so close to you that it's almost as if you're giving up yourself. And of course, it is not scary at all. In fact, this is part of the beauty of the meditation process, that you do give up these things, and then you realize actually it wasn't really you in the first place. There's actually no problem there. It is the delusion that creates the fear. It is the illusion of something that actually causes the terror. But because it is so close to you, that is why this simile here is so strong. Like killers coming out from both sides and wanting to kill you, because there is, in a sense, there is a way in which you are giving up something very, very close to yourself, something that feels like it is you. This can happen in meditation, right? Especially as it gets very deep. Some people start to become fearful quite early on. They kind of lose a little bit of sensation in the body, and already they give rise to a bit of fear. This is quite unusual, but happened to some people. And the deeper you go, the more chances there is that you will encounter a sense of anxiety or feel a bit uncertain what's going to happen now. So how can we deal with that? How can we overcome that kind of fear and anxiety? And the best way to do it is just to keep on doing it again and again and again. And after a while, you get used to it. You get used to the feeling, and you understand that actually there's nothing to fear from this. Quite the contrary, there's everything to be gained. And the fear is just driven by delusion and uncertainty. And beyond that fear, on the other side of that giving up of things, lies something far more interesting, far more exciting. It is like all journeys of discovery. When we're discovering things, when we're on this kind of journey, there's always going to be some uncertainty in that journey, because we are going into new territory. We're going to places we've never been before. And when you go to a new place, there's always going to be some degree of uncertainty and perhaps fear as part of that. But don't allow that to put you off, because there's one aspect of your mind that will recognize there's something really interesting going on here. There's some part which actually knows that there is a treasure lying behind this. And then there's the other part which will feel a sense of fear. So just keep on doing it again and again. Become familiar with these kind of states of mind. And as you do that, you will eventually be able to go beyond this and allow the fear to subside and disappear here. many, many people have done this before you, so there's nothing really to be afraid of. It's just a matter of doing it, carrying on. And then there's the opposite of terror, which is excitement, coming with the next one. So while you're meditating, heedful, keen, and diligent, again perceiving light and vision of forms, but this time, again, it disappears, and excitement arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. When immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was looking for an entrance to a hidden treasure, and all at once they come across five entrances. They would feel excited because of that. In the same way, excitement arose in me. I'll make sure that neither doubt nor loss, nor focus, loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror, nor excitement will arise in me again. So here is the sense that you are really approaching something. This is another very common experience in meditation, and it is a kind of experience that stops you in your tracks. You get excited. That's kind of restlessness and agitation, which is part of the idea of excitement. But the feeling that you are approaching something really interesting and profound, yeah? And the feeling that and that feeling gives rise to excitement, which then destroys the whole thing. It's kind of paradoxical. And the whole thing just dissipates as a consequence. And so after a while, you learn just to be with rather than to react to these things, because being with is what enables these things to happen. So instead of getting excited, you just stay with the experience. And one of the things to remember with these experiences is that they are never really the same. They vary a little bit. They're always a bit different. And so people often say, oh, once I've had an experience, I crave for that experience to have it again in the future. And that craving is part of kind of the excitement here. Yeah, you know that you're approaching something very interesting. Yeah? But the problem is that that experience, it probably will never be repeated anyway. Yeah? So the thing that you are craving for doesn't actually exist. Yeah, what you're craving for is something in the past. It can never be repeated in exactly the same way. So because of that, you are craving, what you're craving for doesn't exist. So there's no point in craving for something which doesn't exist. Yeah, so let go of the craving. Allow something else to arise, because there are so many variations on these themes and so many different ways of experiencing this kind of joys and happinesses and profundity in the meditation. So just allow whatever happens to happen. Yeah, don't have any anticipation, because it's always going to be different. And once you know it's going to be different, once you allow whatever to happen, then this anticipation of something happening, it kind of dies away, because you know it cannot be anticipated, because it is uncertain. This is one way of thinking about it that overcomes that unnecessary excitement and craving. And the other way is just to kind of go gradually, to remember to enjoy what you have. And there's always, if your meditation is reasonably peaceful, there's always some enjoyment in that meditation. Even if it isn't very profound, some degree of enjoyment will be there. It is better than your kind of normal waking state. So you just enjoy whatever you have. You don't know what the future will bring. You don't know how this is going to go. But this is good enough. And when you enjoy what you have, you're content with that, then the meditation tends to develop because of that contentment. This is fine, okay, and then it develops by itself. And then you are happy with the next stage, and you carry on like that, without trying very hard at all. So meditation is always about focusing on the causes, letting go of the results, because the results are uncertain anyway. The cause is in the present, the result is in the future. By focusing on the cause, you're staying in the present. You are learning to be content, enjoying what you have, and that is what deepens, ultimately, the meditation experience. And then you have this simile about the five entrances to a treasure. Again, you can see here how meditation is compared to a treasure, except that it is the most interesting treasure in the world. This is what kind of is the treasure that has to do with the meaning of life itself. a treasure is a bit like an understatement again, but you get the idea. And then you find five entrances to the treasure, yeah, and then you don't know which one shall I take, don't know which entrance is the best one. And you kind of get excited seeing all of these entrances. So what are these five entrances? Why is there five entrances? Why isn't there six, or why isn't there seven? What's going on? What about five? The five here, presumably, it's very hard to know exactly. I haven't checked the commentaries or anything, but it could be that this is a reference to the five jhanas. Yeah, five jhanas, or is there four jhanas? I forget now. Is it four or five? Usually four. So what is the five jhanas? Five jhanas is an alternative enumeration of the jhanas, where the first and the second jhana, there is one in between, like one, the one and a half jhana, whatever you want to call it. So that can makes the enumeration of four into five instead. And you may remember that when we looked at the jhana formula before, it had the idea of applying the mind and sustaining the mind, vitakka vichara. And it is possible to let go of the vitakka and only have the vichara, only the sustaining aspect of the mind. And that is the one and a half jhana. And then you let go of that and you go into the second jhana, right? Which is without vitakka and vichara, without both the applying the mind and the sustaining the mind. The moving the mind onto the object and the holding on, all of that is gone. So there's a different enumerations in the suttas. So this presumably, I would guess, is an enumeration of the five kinds of jhana rather than the four kinds. So all of these are different ways, yeah, with each one of those, it's possible to achieve awakening. That's kind of the point here. Okay, while meditating, discomfort arose in me. So then you will make sure that none of these things arise, discomfort or anything like that. Discomfort here could mean that maybe you hear something like a sound which is uncomfortable. Might even be possible that the body kind of penetrates through and kind of something happens with the body, maybe. Maybe it is a kind of discomfort in the mind even. Anything which is kind of not quite right would then make you withdraw from that state. Most likely maybe some kind of external discomfort in the body, because the mind is pretty cool and good at this time. But some sort of problem arises that distracts you. While meditating, excessive energy arose in me. And because of that, my immersion or samadhi fell away. When the samadhi, the stillness, falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was to grip a quail too tightly in their hands, and it would die right there. Because of that, I'll make sure that none of these problems arise in me again. So excessive energy, is the mind becoming maybe a little bit too excited or too energized? Yeah, you are maybe you're putting forth a little bit of effort again, which you probably shouldn't. You should let go and allow the process just to happen completely by itself. Stand back, be the passenger on the train, not doing anything at all. And as you do that, the energy tends to balance itself out, because the mind just knows what the right balance is. As long as you leave things alone, it tends to go by itself. So you don't want to grip that quail. Yeah, quail is like a small little bird, and small little birds, if you grip them too tightly, they can't live like that. So they die as a consequence, and your meditation dies in the same way if you use too much effort in that meditation. So you allow it to be. The energy is just right. You don't go too far. The next one is overly lax energy arose in me, and because of that my stillness fell away. When stillness falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was to grip a quail too loosely, and it would fly out of their hands. I'll make sure that none of these things arise in the future. And so if you want to hold on to that quail, if you want to hold on to the vision and the light, then you have to, there's maybe some tiny remnant of effort that is left. And that is just the effort of staying with the object, the sense of attending in the right place. And that is really all that is there. The energy of the mind is strong, but there's a tiny bit of effort that maybe has to be done together with that energy. And so you find that balance. Most of the time it's about letting go of effort, because we tend to make always almost too much effort, but occasionally maybe you get it the wrong way around and you don't do anything, and you just and when you don't do anything at all, nothing happens, then the quail flies off, and you are quailless, and quaillessness is a bad idea in this particular case. While meditating, longing arose in me. I'll make sure that neither doubt nor any of these things arise in me again in the future. So longing again, this is, again, probably here, the longing is for a result in your meditation. It's this feeling that you want to be somewhere, you want to go further. And this is one of the problems for most meditators, this feeling of wanting results, longing to be somewhere else. And of course, that takes you out of the present. Longing is always in the future. And because of that, you lose your ability to make further progress. The mind kind of regresses because of that. So again, the idea is to stay with the causes of meditation, not look towards the results, not long for anything, but allow things to be. This is kind of the idea here. And as you stay in the present and you allow the mind to be there, then that is where things come together as a consequence. So longing is a bad idea. Don't long for anything here. But be super-duper content. The opposite of longing here is contentment. And be really content with what is happening here. While meditating, perceptions of diversity arose in me here. Perceptions of diversity is, again, samadhi. The main meaning of samadhi is the idea of stillness. It is often defined as the unity or unification of the mind. And unification of mind just means that there isn't, you know, usually in our experience of the world, there's so many things going on. So many things happening. Just by opening your eyes right now, you see a million things taken on board. And the samadhi experience, the stillness experience, is the opposite of that. It's things becoming incredibly simple. And so your perception of reality is super duper simple. All you have is a light, and a very simple light. Nothing else is going on in all your perception. So you don't want the diversity, you want unification of the mind. That is what the meaning of samadhi is. Chittassa ekagata, the one-pointedness of mind. So when you have something like this samadhi nimittas, as they're called sometimes, the vision of forms and the light, you stay with the simplest aspect of that, focusing on the center of the object, not going to the edges. Once you go to the edge, there is diversity here, because the edge is precisely the limit between two different things. And so there is diversity straight away here. So you stay with the most simple and basic aspect of the meditation object. This is what is meant here by not paying attention to diversity. So you avoid the diversity and you go to the unity of the experience instead. While meditating, heedful, keen, and diligent, I perceived both light and a vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what is the cause, what is the reason why my light and vision of forms vanish? It occurred to me, excessive concentration or staring on forms arose in me. And because of that, my stillness fell away. When stillness falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. I'll make sure that neither doubt, nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror, nor excitement, nor discomfort, nor excessive energy, nor overly lax energy, nor longing, nor perception of diversity, nor excessive staring at forms will arise in me again. So the word here for excessive concentration is something like staring. Yeah, you're staring at something. You're becoming a little bit obsessed with something. Yeah? And you are staring at the forms here. And overly focusing on the forms will mean that that becomes the main object of your meditation, and then the light, as a consequence, becomes less important, and the form becomes what is important, and then the whole samadhi experience falls away. Because the light is the power. The light is often where the joy and the happiness is. That's the brightness of the mind. And if you take your focus instead onto the form quality of things, then you lose kind of a very important aspect of that experience. So you don't put excessive staring on the forms, but you stay with the light as well. And one of the interesting things about these sort of experiences is that they can be quite... They can have many different meanings to them. One meaning is that this is a samadhi nimitta which takes you into samadhi through these visions. You actually enter the jhana states and all of that. But sometimes they can also be different things. And one of the things that these things can be, they can be also, for example, this is how devas can be seen in a meditation. Yeah, a deva can look very similar. And a deva will very often have a form, right? So if you are interested in perceiving the devas, then you may very well be interested more in the form of what is going on than the light, yeah, because you want to engage somehow, you want to find out what's going on. So these things are not always... what is going on is not always entirely obvious, and you need to kind of get used to these kind of experiences to know exactly what is happening here. Yeah. So again, you find that balance, yeah? Form and the light coming together, focusing on that, letting go of all of these defilements, and then yeah, your meditation really happens as a consequence. So then the Buddha says, when I understood that doubt is a corruption of the mind, I gave it up. When I understood that loss of focus, dullness and drowsiness, terror, excitement, discomfort, excessive energy, overly lax energy, longing, perception of diversity, and excessive staring at forms are corruptions of the mind, I gave them up. So the idea here is that you have to understand, first of all, what the corruptions are. Yeah. And then once you understand that, then you give it up because you understand that it is a problem. So you find the way to giving them up, and then you that's what you do. So this is the kind of the idea here. And that list of factors that you see there, they are a lot of these are similar to the five hindrances. Yeah, if you look at that list, you will see that they are very closely related in many ways to the five hindrances. Obviously, dullness and drowsiness is that. Excitement is often to do with an excessive energy, often have to do with restlessness, etc. And so they can be kind of classified into the five hindrances. Longing is a kind of desire. Perceptions of diversity is a kind of restlessness. So they kind of fit into the idea of the five hindrances, but it's just a more refined way of classifying. And when you have more refinement, it is easier to find the countermeasures to stop these things from happening, because you are very clear about what is going on. And this is the idea here. So very often in meditation, all kinds of things can be going on. And you will have to kind of look at your own meditation to understand. This is not like a final or exhaustive list. It is just a kind of list of prominent things that may happen. And then you have to kind of figure these things out on your own, because everyone is slightly different. So then you give it up because you know these things are problematic. Yeah, you don't want to hold on to those problematic things. So you give it up, you find a way around them, you understand why they occur, and you avoid the same problem in the future. While meditating, heedful, keen, and diligent, I perceived light, but did not see forms. I saw forms, but did not see light. And this went on for a whole night, a whole day, even a whole night and day. I thought, what is the cause? What is the reason for this? It occurred to me, when I don't focus on the foundation of forms, but focus on the foundation of the light, then I perceive light and do not see forms. But when I don't focus on the foundation of the light, but focus on the foundation of the forms, then I see forms and do not perceive light. And this goes on for a whole night, a whole day, even a whole night and day. So here, the Buddha takes it further. It's amazing, kind of the detail that he goes into here in terms of meditation. It's kind of fascinating. So he perceived light, but did not see forms, right? So this would be a state of mind where the mind is very bright, but there's no container for that light. There's no form that goes with it. The whole kind of perception is just very bright and full of light. And sometimes people have these perceptions. And you hear about it, because when you listen to many people's meditation experience, all of these experiences are had by people. So all you have is a kind of a bright mind state, but there's no form, there's no shape to it. And then you see forms, but no light. And this is a very common experience in meditation. People see things, shapes, but it doesn't come with a bright light necessarily. It can be colors, it can be all kind of things, but not necessarily a bright mental quality that is there. And so this is interesting that the Buddha should say this, because it gives us an idea that actually that combination of form or shape together with light actually seems to be necessary for the meditation to progress properly. So we should aim towards these kind of precisely this sort of thing that the Buddha is talking about here, this thing that is called usually samadhi nimitta, a shape together with a bright light coming together. That is the most powerful experience that can draw you into samadhi. And for some reason, it's kind of obvious in a way, because when you have a shape, the shape allows you to focus. Because it's obvious where the mind should stay. You have a very clear object in your mind that allows you to keep the focus on something. If everything is just bright, it is more difficult to be focused. And the light is necessary, because that is the energy of the mind. That is the beauty, that is the bliss that comes to you at this particular point. And that combination of bliss combined with the ability to focus is what enables the samadhi to go all the way, to be taken all the way into the jhanas, etc., etc. So it is kind of, this gives an idea here, right here, that actually these lights in the mind are probably necessary for samadhi to happen. This seems to be pretty much what the Buddha is saying here. This is what we should develop as we go along. This is what we should allow to arise. We should use the meditation in such a way for this to happen. And how does that happen? And this is what he says next. He says that when I don't focus on the foundation of forms, but focus on the foundation of light, then you perceive light, but not forms. So what does this mean, the foundation of forms? The foundation of forms is just an interest in the forms. It's just the whatever kind of give rise to the seeing of a form or seeing of a light. That is the foundation. Very often it's about interest, it's about what you pay your attention to, etc. These kind of things. So the foundation here, the Pali word again, is nimitta. Nimitta means like the cause, the basis for something, the object, the foundation, the thing that drives the meditation. So you just want to have a balanced kind of attention, a balanced interest. And when you have that balanced interest in meditation, then usually you will see both as a consequence. You are producing the foundation for these things. So when you have that balance, then both happens. If you're only interested in lights, you will probably only see lights, because your mind will go in that direction. And then there's the opposite. If you're only interested in forms, you will see forms, because you are keen on seeing all kind of weird and wonderful things in your meditation. Many people have these experiences. When they meditate, the mind becomes very creative, and they see all kinds of things in the mind's eye, and they get really excited about it. And then they come and say, "Oh, I'm seeing these things in my meditation. What does it mean?" I don't know what it means. Who knows what it means? That's impossible to know, because these are just fabrications of the mind. The mind is a fabricator. The mind is very creative. Everything in the world is ultimately made by the mind, one way or another. And so because of that, when the mind starts to become peaceful, it starts to create. It depends on your personality. Some people have very vivid kind of imagination, and all kind of things get painted in their mind's eye. Yeah, all kind of interesting things. And sometimes you think it's your past life. Sometimes you think it's just visions of heaven. If you are really lucky, it's visions of hell. Yeah, visions of heaven are dangerous. You kind of draw visions of hell. Whoa, okay, I better do something with this. And so you get all of these kind of things drawn up in your mind. And it is because the mind is very powerful and creative. So in a sense, it is a good sign. It's a good sign because it means that your mind is becoming peaceful and energized. And the mind is actually has that ability to draw these things up. But it's not really where you want to go because it's unbalanced. You have the forms without the light. And so you want to go beyond that. How do you go beyond that? Well, you go beyond that by coming back to the breath, not paying attention to those beautiful sceneries or whatever it is that you see here. Yeah? Play around it with a while if you want to, but after a while, just stay with the breath. And then that scenery, that imagination may still be there, but that is not your main focus. Yeah, your main focus is the breath. This is one of those things in meditation, is that many things can happen at the same time. Yeah, you are watching the breath, but you can also feel bliss at the same time. So very often it's about what is the primary object, what is the main thing that we're using, and other things are kind of going on in the background at the same time. So here you just come back to the breath, you calm things down more. After a while those visions of forms, they start to disappear, and the samadhi nimitta arises in its place, yeah? And that is when you are on the right track. So it seems from what the Buddha is saying here that actually the bright lights in the mind, the form and the light, actually is a very important part of the meditation experience. And that to gain full samadhi, it may very well be a requirement. It is one of those things that often come up in meditation circles. What do you have to have these nimittas to go all the way? And looking at this, I would say probably. Okay. Then the Buddha goes on. While meditating, diligent, keen, and heedful, keen, and diligent, I perceived limited light and saw limited forms. I perceived limitless light and saw limitless forms. And this went on for a whole night, a whole day, even a whole night and day. I thought, what is the cause, what is the reason for this? It occurred to me, when my stillness is limited, my vision is limited. And with a limited vision, I perceive limited light and see limited forms. When my immersion is limitless, then my vision is limitless. And with limitless vision, I perceive limitless light and see limitless forms. And this goes on for a whole night, a whole day, and even a whole night and day. So here the idea is to develop a kind of samadhi, a kind of stillness that is without limits, doesn't have any boundaries. And sometimes in the suttas, they talk about samadhi, where you stretch your mind over a particular area. Yeah, over a particular, it talks about like, you know, a village or a village field or something like that. And that is the limit of your samadhi. But the idea here is to have a samadhi without that kind of limit, that kind of goes beyond, doesn't have any boundaries to it. And when you have that sort of samadhi, then you get the limitless visions and limitless forms as a consequence. And how do you do that? Well, you just do it by keeping on doing the Anapanasati meditation, following the instructions in the Anapanasati Sutta, and just allowing the whole thing to develop by itself. And it will develop in this way if you just kind of stand back and don't try to kind of create these kind of things. This is kind of the natural tendency of the mind to go in this direction. So you just allow the mind to develop. You don't limit it by focusing on narrow kind of objects, but you allow it to develop unhindered. So this is what the Buddha to be did, and this is how he overcame the limits in his meditation. And once he did that, he was ready for going all the way to the end of the path. So then he says, after understanding that doubt, loss of focus, dullness and drowsiness, terror, excitement, discomfort, excessive energy, overly lax energy, longing, perception of diversity, and excessive staring of forms are corruptions of the mind, I had given them up. And I thought, I have given up my mental corruptions. Now let me develop the samadhi in three ways. I developed samadhi while placing the mind and keeping it connected. Without placing the mind, but just keeping it connected. Without placing the mind or keeping it connected. With rapture, without rapture, with pleasure, and with equanimity. So these are... Here you can get a feeling for this idea of the five jhanas I was talking about before. And so here you get this thing, and so the Buddha then develops the samadhi in all of these kind of ways. And again, as you can see here, this would have taken some time. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on here with developing the mind, and it probably took many days or weeks even for the Buddha to develop all of these things fully, so that eventually he could achieve the awakening. So what we have here is that you develop the immersion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. This is the first jhana experience. The idea here that these two words are the vitakka, vichara in Pali, placing the mind and keeping it connected. Vitakka, vichara is are the things that give the first jhana its particular feel. This together with the kind of happiness and bliss that you experience is what actually identifies something as the first jhana experience. And the idea of placing the mind and keeping it connected is like a moving onto the object and then holding on and then releasing. It's kind of wobble, it's a kind of rhythm in the first jhana. It's not, the samadhi is not 100% yet, it's not absolute stillness. There's a slight movement of the mind. But it's not a voluntary movement. It's not something that you are doing. It's something the mind does by itself. Yeah, the mind just does these things. The slight volition that remains, the will that remains in the mind. And so the mind is kind of pulsating in a certain way. Yeah, slowly moving back and forth in this way. And that is the hallmark of the first jhana experience. So the full stillness is not there, but the five senses are gone. The hindrances are all gone. There is just bliss, is a particular kind of bliss, and the bliss is called the Vivekaja Piti Sukha. And Vivekaja Piti Sukha means the piti and sukha, the happiness that is born of seclusion, viveka being seclusion. Seclusion from what? Seclusion from the five senses in particular, and also the five hindrances. So that is the first jhana for you. Yeah, when you go through this whole sequence, you give up these upakilesas, the mind is pure and bright, there's no excitement, and all you are just allowing the whole process to happen. There comes a point when you leave behind the kama loka, the world of the five senses, and you enter into the state of the first jhana. There's a transformation in the mind that happens as you kind of leave that world completely behind. And that transformation, that is the falling into the first jhana. And the moment you do that, you cannot really extract yourself anymore. This is an automatic thing, and you stay there for however long that experience is to be felt, depending on the kind of momentum in your mind and all of these kind of things. There's this movement from one thing to something else. This is the first jhana experience. And if the power of your samadhi is more, then it doesn't stop in the first jhana, but it goes into the 1.5 jhana. And the 1.5 jhana is without placing the mind, but still keeping it connected. Yeah, so the wobble is gone, but there's still some degree of the mind kind of holding on to what is happening here. It is not yet an absolute full samadhi. We are just with something 100%. There's some kind of holding on going on in the mind. The one and a half jhana. Then you enter the second jhana, and the second jhana is where the placing of the mind and the holding on are both completely let go of. And this is the first time in your life you experience full samadhi, full stillness of the mind. And so this, what does it mean, full stillness of the mind? What it means is that things are not changing at all. There's one perception, one feeling, one way, one experience that goes on and on and on and on without any kind of change. That is the idea of full samadhi, yeah? Just things going on and on and on and on. And it is kind of very strange when that happens. And again, it's not something that you do voluntarily. It's something that just happens to you. And of course, it is the most powerful experience you had in your life, the highest kind of bliss. Yeah, this at this point, your bliss is just kind of really reaching proportions you didn't even have no idea were even possible. This is called the samadhija pittisukha, the happiness and the bliss born of complete stillness of the mind. This is kind of the second jhana experience. First jhana, one and a half jhana, second jhana. And then you go even further. This is just the beginning. You go beyond this as well. And then it talks about, in fact, the stillness that is without vitakka, without vichara, avitakka, avichara. This is really the stillness of the second jhana, the third jhana, and also the fourth jhana, because all of these do not have vitakka and vichara, right? And then it goes on. It talks about with rapture. Rapture is piti. So there is immersion or samadhi with rapture. That's the first jhana, one and a half jhana, second jhana. These are all with rapture. So this is a different way of thinking about the jhanas, classifying it slightly differently. Then there is the jhana without rapture. And that is the third and the fourth jhana. They are without rapture. You have gone beyond rapture, gone beyond the joy of the mind. Then there is the jhana with pleasure. And jhana with pleasure are the first three jhanas. They all have sukha. Sukha is the Pali word for pleasure here. And that exists in all the first three jhanas and also the one and a half jhana. And then there is the last one is the jhanas with equanimity. And that again is the third and the fourth jhana. Especially the fourth jhana is where you have equanimity. Upeka. Upeka, the adukkama sukha. Neither happiness nor a pain, but upeka instead in the fourth jhana. So this is the a scheme, a classification of the various jhanas. And this is where you enter an alternative reality, where you leave behind everything that you have done, everything you had, your entire lived experience has been an immersion in the world of the five senses from the moment you were born until the moment you enter the jhana for the first time. And now you enter an alternative reality. And no wonder it can be extraordinarily exciting, because the happiness and joy is completely otherworldly, something you have never experienced before. At the same time, it is also a bit... This is one of the reasons I talk about the fear here, because you're entering something else, you're leaving behind everything you have ever known. And of course that is going to be a little bit concerning. But once you learn how to let go of that five-sense world, you understand that the five-sense world is problematic. Actually, it is not very interesting, because now you have entered something completely different that is far more interesting, far more fulfilling, far more meaningful than anything you ever had before. And this is the realm of the jhana, the rupa-vachara, or the rupa-loka, this is called in the suttas. Rupa is a form realm, the realm of the four jhanas. So this is what the Buddha does. And of course, once you do that, you start to gain a very powerful understanding of the nature of the world, because you understand fully what the five senses are. You understand what the will is and why the will is problematic. All of that has been left behind, and you are much more happy than you've ever been before as a consequence. So these are pregnant with insight, full of potential of insight, these experiences, because precisely you have left so much behind, and you understand the difference. Okay, so then after going through all of these jhanas up to the fourth jhana is of course the end of the Noble Eightfold Path. You don't have to go beyond the fourth jhana. That is the most powerful place from which to achieve awakening, the fourth jhana. And then the Buddha says, when I had developed samadhi, stillness in these ways, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My freedom is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there are no more future lives. So after attaining the fourth jhana, it's almost guaranteed that you become awakened, at least you become one of the stages of awakening, because the insight potential is so incredibly powerful at this point. And in case of the Buddha, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My freedom is unshakable. Akuppa, Cheto Vimutti. Akuppa means there is no going back again. You have reached a high stage and you will stay there for the rest of your life, and then you make an end of it all. This is my last rebirth. You know that you will not be born again. This is one of the knowledges that arises when you become awakened. And you may wonder, why, how is that possible? How can you possibly know that you will not get reborn? And the reason you know is because you know the causes for rebirth have been eliminated. You have understood through your insight the causes of rebirth. And because the causes of rebirth are gone, you cannot be reborn again in the future. The link between craving and rebirth has been understood, and you have eliminated the cause. Then now there will be no more future lives. That is what the Buddha said. Satisfied, Venerable Anuruddha was happy with what the Buddha said. There you are. That is the famous Upakilesa Sutta for you. So please use this if you need as instructions in your meditation. It is very detailed and a very, to my mind, very interesting sutta. But that is all for now. So please carry on, enjoy yourself, have a nice lunch, and we'll see you back again at 3:00 this afternoon.